Politics, protests, and
potpourri.
KBOO Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Trippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corelia, and my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
And we have a very exciting episode tonight. One of the people that I run into very often in my journalistic misadventures, Sarah Rudolph. Hey, go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us what groups you're with.
Hey, this is Sarah. I work primarily with a group called Portland Assembly. We do neighborhood organizing, which is sort of, we think of ourselves more as like a network than an actual organization, because what we do is try to connect people with people who are like-minded in their areas so that they can work on projects together. And so that means that, like, our group doesn't always do the same stuff that other neighborhood groups that are Portland Assembly do. But oddly enough, most of our groups have ended up focusing on houseless issues.
Nice, nice. I mean, that's kind of why me and you run into each other. I do neighborhood news. So, you know, it's very much the same field that we're both running in with. So, there's several topics that you have actually been involved with recently that I kind of wanted to jump into. Most recently, I know there was the campaign for Stop the Sweeps.
Yeah, we just had the official kickoff a couple weeks ago. So that's going to involve it's pretty exciting. It's a houseless-led campaign. The coalition was started by some unhoused folks in the sort of central east side area that a lot of us met when we were originally working to stop the Central East Side Industrial Council from forming up. So that was a business improvement district that they've formed in the Central East Side, which, just so you know what a business improvement district is, it's a special designation where the business owners and developers in a neighborhood get together and they decide that they are going to work together to patrol their neighborhood, to clean their neighborhood. And so they assess fees from all the businesses and homeowners in the area. And then they also use parking fees. So they levy actual taxes, like public money, to increase policing in their areas through private policing. And
like
then
security guards.
Yeah, yeah. And also things like, you know, increased sweeps so they can have, like, an independent company like Clean and Safe, which is in the downtown business improvement district, that they can contract to do sweeps.
And by sweep, you mean the same kind of sweep that Rapid Restaurants BioClean is doing to remove people's tarps, tents, and sleeping bags and things.
Right, except it's not conducted by the city. They're still using partially city money. But these are actually being ordered by business owners, by like these business improvement districts. And, what we've noticed, like, for example, in the Central East Side is that these, entities have been doing sweeps. So, you know, with the city, sweeps are supposed to happen because of a complaint, right? Lodged through the one point of contact thing. Don't use it. It's for snitches. but what we've noticed, especially in Central East Side, because this is where we've been tracking and paying attention, is that these sweeps are on schedules. They're absolutely not they're not triggered by calls, by complaint calls, because they have them scheduled for weeks in advance. They post for a 10-day period and sweep every 7 days.
Which isn't that a violation of the Anderson Agreement?
It, for all intents and purposes, should be. But okay, this is why we have trouble with business districts, is because they get around, like, actual laws that way.
I wonder about the legality of the businesses hiring a private company to do sweeps if we have a law in our city that regulates how houseless camps get swept or cleaned up.
Well, yeah, and they're supposed to be going along with those rules, but we see a lot of room for, like, I mean, there's no citizen oversight there.
Yeah.
like even less than there is with our normal city bureaus, which is minimal at best, you know. So, but with this, like, we don't even have the right to ask for that.
And what bothers me too with the Downtown Clean and Safe, I believe that program also hires low barrier individuals that are experiencing homelessness. So essentially, they're sweeping their own community.
Oh yeah, and I was at a sweep over here on this side a couple months ago, and there were folks from Project Action, I think is the one on the east side. Although I think they recently changed either their name or changed contractors, because I just have heard reports of a new company.
Okay.
So I'm not. I'm actually like looking for information on that right now.
Something that we spoke about with one of our guests, Q, is the changing names of all these groups.
Is making it Q Laquita?
Yes, Laquita.
Oh,
yes.
My girl.
She was awesome. We spoke with her and we talked about that, how difficult it is to track some of what these organizations are doing. And
well, and they do it on purpose. Like the one over on this side, Project Action, they have like a co-company, or they did. This seems to have changed at this point. But one of the companies was the security group. And so it was Portland Patrol. And then Project Action was the group that they had formed that was still the same company that was there to do the cleanup.
Hmm.
So, and so we have at sweeps, we'll have those companies which do, as you say, hire low barrier individuals, which I feel like we did a bad thing with the CEIC in those negotiations because we gave them a lot of language to use against us. And low barrier is one of those terms that I feel like now is being almost weaponized against the houseless community. Because what we were talking about was peer-run, peer-supported endeavors. So things like safe sleep sites, things like the, you know, the hygiene program that would be run by people who use the services, right?
Hazelnut Grove might even be a good example.
Exactly. And that's what low barrier actually means.
Yeah.
So now it's turned around and is, I mean, the CEIC tried to come back and say that they were going to use low barrier uniforms, which as far as we could tell just meant undercover private security.
Huh.
Yeah, so that's been a really weird thing to sort of watch that language shift.
Yeah.
So you'll end up with unhoused individuals. I was at a sweep where I saw unhoused folks doing the actual physical labor. Three police departments, because they were also using inmate labor.
Hmm.
So the sheriff was there to observe that.
Hmm.
So this is the spread of like services that are being used, and a lot. And so you're using incarcerated labor for that already.
I see. See, myself, I've only seen the sweeps happening over in Lentz,
mm-hmm.
along the trail there. And it's usually rapid response BioClean.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys just come in. I usually see them about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. When people are off getting stuff at, like, the service center, Clackamas Service Center over there, and usually just come in, don't even care, and just start grabbing up tents, all the stuff inside, just throwing in the back of the truck and take off.
Yeah, well, with Springwater, we've always been actually really grateful that the rangers are as nice as they are, because they will tell us when stuff is going to happen.
Yeah.
So that you can warn people.
It's awesome when you see a little bit of humanity and someone doing their job.
Yeah, and it is part of their job, because like they're there to help the people who are using those areas, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not cops. Like, they don't have to be. And sometimes they choose to act like that, but they don't have to be. Yeah, like, they always target, like, the worst times. You know, it's always, like, 6 in the morning or 10 o'clock or, you know, 3 o'clock when people are still at work. Like,
yeah, when people are either out or, like, working or still asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's plenty of times I've just been around town and I've seen the rapid response trucks packed in the back, the pickups with belongings, you know, headed to somewhere.
Yeah.
And just wondered, oh, gosh, you know, who doesn't have a sleeping bag tonight?
Well,
it's like 30, 40 degrees out.
My sister and I were just talking about this today, like trying to think about how much money we spend a year, maybe. And that's just us, like each of us on things like tarps and sleeping bags and blankets and clothes for people. And this is just stuff that is literally stolen by the city.
Yeah, this is stuff you're replacing.
Yeah,
One of the aspects I've been wanting to explore, too, is how much money is going into these resource centers that are replacing the stuff that has been taken.
Thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, I was thinking, like, so I probably spent and I cannot afford this, y'all. Like, none of the people that I know who do outreach service can afford to do what they do. Like, I feed people out of my kitchen. People feed other people off food stamps. Like, this is poor people helping poor people. So if you are rich and you have resources, like, get them to the people who are doing outreach because, yeah.
I think that's the thing, is that poor people are helping poor people because they know what it's like. They understand what the challenges are and what some of the real needs are and what can really help somebody, like, get a hold on their day or whatever their situation is. And people that are well-to-do often not have been through those circumstances and just cannot grasp what somebody really needs. They have so much, you know, I hate to say it, but there's so many judgments and opinions that are really kind of unfounded by experience, because they haven't had them.
Yeah, if a $25 overdraft fee wouldn't, like, screw your entire life, then you probably don't have any idea what people are going through.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like, and so, yeah, and because it is so easy for people to distance themselves, I've spent a lot of my life working sort of in fields that make it so that I work directly for rich people. Mm-hmm. And there is something that we are encouraged to do the more money we make, where we separate ourselves from poor people. Mm-hmm. And it makes it easier just not to see them as people. And I see that all the time with people who, it's not even that they don't understand what poor people go through or what it might be like to be unhoused, but they don't actually think of them as human. Like, it is just this slow dehumanization process that happens the more zeros go into your paycheck. Like, and that's what capitalism and white supremacy do actively on purpose, like, to keep this system going.
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, so I figure I probably spend, let's say, a really, really low estimate. Like, so if we're not talking about feeding people, right, because I spend more money on that, too. But, like, if it's just, say, tarps and blankets and clothes and stuff, I probably spend $100 every 2 weeks. Mm. Like, so $200 a month. On just trying to keep people alive. And that's, again, not replacing medications that get stolen, glasses. And I'm going to just say stolen because people rarely get that stuff back. Like, the people who are doing cleanup are encouraged to look at people's possessions as garbage. They often do not save important paperwork, people's social security cards, things like that.
You're mixing objects together that, if you're moving from, you know, apartment to apartment, you would not put these objects in a box together. You would not throw these things in a bag. You know,
yeah.
Ceramic plates and picture frames and paperwork and mm-hmm. half-eaten burrito.
Exactly.
You just wouldn't put them all in a single bag and say it'll be good for when you come find it within 30 days.
With your wet sleeping bag and in a storeroom.
Right.
For, yeah.
They took it all down in the rain and none of that has been taken care of.
And my own experience up there in Lentz, I've seen them just, like I said, grabbing entire tents and throwing them in. They're not marking them or anything. So how are they tracking?
Oh, I've talked to so many people. I have talked to so many people who, when they get their, quote unquote, get their stuff back, it is a bag of random stuff that may or may not have one or two of their items in it, but usually is just a bunch of stuff. So it is that, I mean, that's one of the things. So we were talking about the sweeps campaign. One of the things that we're working on is putting together teams to help folks who are getting swept to reclaim their possessions, but also to track how poorly that system is functioning.
I wonder if having a group that would go and document when sweeps are occurring, someone like videoing, mm-hmm. like having an outside group documenting what's going on might help track some of the belongings during some of these sweeps and figure out what's really happening. Because it seems like it's very hard for the people in the middle of the sweeps. They're having those objects taken that could even help them. If they had a phone or a camera, it was probably in their tent that got swept.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
Well, and it's also really difficult to pay attention to things like documenting when your whole life is being upended in front of you.
Right.
So that is definitely something that supporters and allies of unhoused folks can do. And we are working on building those support structures. But if you have a group of people who know how to film stuff like that on the street, if you have a group of people who are super into like data processing and collection and want to like help us catalog stuff like that, there's a group that is part of this coalition that's Western Regional Advocacy Project, RAP, and they do a lot of amazing research and statistic keeping, but they're based out of San Francisco, and most of the statistics that they've been collecting lately have been for San Francisco and Denver, yeah. Because they've been doing some major work there. So we are trying to work on the Portland end of it right now. So any like folks that are interested in that, you can plug into the Stop the Sweeps campaign. We meet Mondays at 2:00 at SJAC, which is on 12th and Oak Southeast. And we would love to have more folks working on it because there's a lot of work to do.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff being thrown around about the sweeps, like the sweeps kill. And I remember just reading recently, I think it was a Street Roots article, and it was talking about that exact situation.
About Debbie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you can give a little bit of background because you already seem to know this.
Well, Debbie was one of our folks, our guests at Sunnyside. So Portland Assembly, one of the things that we do and have done is run warming shelters, emergency warming shelters. So the Montevilla warming shelter was one of our projects. It's kind of an autonomous project at this point, but we, you know, try to support them. And then we were running the shelter at Sunnyside as well, which a new congregation moved in.
And that's the one in the story that Debbie had visited.
Yeah. So this is, yeah. And we were over there on 35th and Yamhill. And then a new, the United Methodist Church told us that a new congregation was moving in. And that they might want to change some stuff, but they kind of were reassuring that it would be okay. And then we went through some meetings with them. And then we got 30 days notice for that the program would be kicked out. And this isn't just the warming shelter. This is like more important. Well, not more importantly, but just as importantly, a program that Pat Schweibert had been running there for 38 years that started with a weekly dinner and expanded to meals almost daily, showers, a pantry, a clothing closet, and a really, really solid community. And so we still do food service at the park across the street because the folks that used the services at Sunnyside lived in the neighborhood, and they still do because it's their neighborhood. So Debbie was one of our folks there, and she had recently had surgery after a medical incident and was, as many are, released to the streets and had been swept a few times and did not have the medication that she needed. It feels dramatic, but it also feels very true to say that she was directly killed by sweep.
Yeah. I mean, when you're out there on the streets, it can be difficult to even to try and get replacement medications. If you even have the time,
she didn't have
energy.
Her medications for the last week of her life.
And that surgery she had was, you know, it affected her mobility, right? So she wasn't easy to get around or go very far.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and also, I mean, there's an opiate problem in America, and people are overprescribed all the time, and people are very, very suspicious of folks who are unhoused about addiction.
And they somehow don't believe that unhoused persons have real, actual medical conditions that require necessary medication to be healthy again or to at least survive.
Yeah. And, and moreover, like, there's just the stigma around that also makes it very difficult. So if you get, you know, if your medication is confiscated, is stolen by the cops, then you have to request that refill, and your doctor may not give it to you.
Yeah, they're going to question, what happened to this medication? Yeah. Oh, it was taken during a homeless sweep. I don't think a doctor's really going to sit there and listen to that.
It's not like they write receipts for confiscated property, yeah. right? So, like, you don't actually know what they took. You don't have proof of that. So there are all kinds of obstacles that throws up.
At the extreme end, the only proof you're going to have of that sweep happening is if they fine you. Mm-hmm. And that happens occasionally, but yeah. it's not every time.
But even then, like, that doesn't say, it's just...
Yeah.
It's just really frustrating because, like, it definitely feels like the city is directly doing these things that we then have to try to fix. Like, they're hurting people, and they have the choice not to do that, right? It is, and we were talking before, I don't know where my statistics on it are, but I would check the Western Regional Advocacy Project page because they have a ton of good information and lots of data there. But it's definitely true that sweeps do not help the unhoused situation, right? They don't put anybody into housing. They don't make it safer for anyone. Statistics indicate that there's an increase in crime in neighborhoods where people have been recently swept, which makes sense because you have just taken somebody's worldly possessions.
So they're trying to replace
it. And they have to survive. I mean, they're not even necessarily trying to replace it. They might just be trying to stay warm for the night.
Yeah.
Like
break into someone's car to sleep.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Like, which, you know, I've definitely had someone do that. But I have people on the street who, when it gets cold enough, like we've had a lot of cold nights, but not a lot of open shelter nights this year. And
even then, the shelters are in certain places. They're not always easy to get to. They don't support all different communities that are all across the city.
Well, yeah, and it's true. I would love to see, and this is a stopgap measure, because what we really need is just free housing for everybody. Yeah. Housing first. It's a thing. But I would love to see shelters in every neighborhood, you know, and that's the way that those systems work the best, I think, is when you're not asking for, you know, a huge program to be administrated, like the Wapato thing, like that's 950 beds.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that there is an organization in the state who is ready to take that on, which means that it'll be privatized, which means that it'll be run like a jail because the only companies that exist to do that sort of thing are prison companies.
Which is why everyone is so against it, because mm-hmm. it is so jail-like, and it'll have that penalizing feeling for people being there. Run in a prison-like environment. I mean, it was built to be a jail.
Well, even if they could make it look like... even if they could make it look like a nursery or a garden, you're going to have these private prison companies running this place, right? So what happens when... They get paid by the bed.
Yeah.
They get paid by full beds. So what happens when your beds aren't full and there's still unhoused folks outside? Like, at what point does it become compulsory?
Yeah.
Like, they're already talking in Northern California about giving people who work in shelters the right to commit people.
Hmm.
So that those of us who do outreach could be tasked with determining whether someone is capable of taking care of themselves or not, which I don't think most of us are comfortable with or would want anything to do with.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's difficult, and I'm going to say that, like, my friends and I spend a lot of time talking about, like, models and how this could look and how to build a society where care is everyone's job, where people have access to the resources that they need, and when they're in trouble, everybody knows how to get them to those resources. But we're not there by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea of, like, somebody who works at a shelter being able to put somebody under psychiatric hold is terrifying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this whole Stop the Sweeps campaign was, it was mainly started because the city's basically throwing money at the sweeps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing, like, I think it's supposed to be, like, a five-folder or something like that of how much they were putting into it.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're putting millions into it, really. Yeah. And if we look at, like, if we add in things like the recent Boulder projects, where the city spent...
aggressive architecture.
Yeah, hostile architecture.
Spikes and spikes and boulders. Those are also in those business improvement districts you were mentioning.
Yeah, they do a lot of that sort of thing, or like planters that don't really have plants in them, but certainly make it so you can't put a tent up on the street.
The benches downtown with the metal arm rails that go right down the middle so that you only have about 3 feet on either side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and take a look, like when you are in a business improvement district, and it's important to notice how this goes along with development.
There's no overhangs off.
Yeah, there's no overhangs. There's no benches. Like, so these are all areas where, Donald Trump's a developer. We all know that, right? Like, so it should not be surprising to any of us that like the laws have become incredibly good for developers, and that they have pulled millions and millions and like billions of dollars out of this region.
Portland has brought in a lot of developer money in the last decade or so.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You wouldn't think that there would be like huge swaths of the city that would still be considered blighted. And yet, about 2 years ago, Trump declared this program called the Opportunity Zone program.
Yes, I just heard about this.
Yeah, it's, yeah, oh God. So basically, like the governor, Kate Brown, thanks very much, determined that certain portions of Portland would be, and I think Bend also, like there's some opportunity zones in Bend. So any area that is considered blighted, and that's in scare quotes, can be declared an opportunity zone. Well, most of Portland has been declared an opportunity zone. So anything, the CEIC, so which is below 12th, between 12th and the river, all of that is an opportunity zone. All of downtown Portland is an opportunity zone. Now, think about the amount of development that Portland has seen in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Enormous. Foster doesn't look the same. All these.
I mean, Division is just a canyon now.
North Portland.
Oh, my gosh. You're right. Yeah, Division. It's nothing but these tall, giant buildings. It's been constant construction for the last.
I mean, and North Portland happened before that, really.
Yeah,
like,
that was
already happening.
Yeah.
Like, because, of course, like, poor black areas are going to be, like, targeted first. And they have been, like, historically. So, like. I mean,
Mississippi, Alberta, St. John's, those have all seen a lot of that development. And those are also areas where you're seeing a lot of mom and pop shops, a lot of stores that have been around for decades, even.
Yeah.
At least 10 to 50 years, I mean, even longer. But these businesses are disappearing. Every week I am seeing another business pop up saying, we can't afford our rent anymore. Things have changed. I'm sorry, we're going out of business.
Well, and it's replaced by another nondescript coffee shop with a cement floor and
now you can
like
just tell
blonde
us,
wood furniture that just looks like every other place.
It just looks like there's some sort of like big, generic look to it that just, that they went like the Costco style and they just put them everywhere.
It's
so that doesn't mean it's a big money look.
It's like Sims developer.
Yes,
like,
Sims. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so. So all of Portland basically is an opportunity zone, despite like our hyper development over the last 10 years. So that means that there are incentives for building in those areas. And this drives the desire to clean them up and make them shiny so that they can attract that developer money.
Kind of in sociology, the whole broken window mentality.
Yeah, but it's kind of the other way. It's like a curb appeal. You're trying to like clean it up because now they're selling it. So, I mean, we've been like gentrification, like started out by like selling to people who already lived here, and then it started by selling to people who were moving in from out of town. But now we're trading like what is imaginary real estate with people who live overseas with companies, right? So, like, most of, like, the properties that are changing hands are just changing hands between corporations at this point. So we're looking at, like, the thing that happened with mortgages in 2008 happening again, except it's with rent, which is horrifying. So we're all about to be underwater. Like, as far as that goes. But, I mean, they don't live here, so what are they going to do when we just take their buildings? Like, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching several people in my circle that are homeowners that are just completely vacating Portland because they can't handle it anymore. They're getting taxed too much and all that. Rent's going up on certain people, so they're ending up moving way out into like the numbers.
It's difficult when to travel around the city. Mm-hmm. Can't get to places anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a lot that has been basically like offered up to try and address the situation with the homelessness, like we were talking before the show with the churches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's only a few churches that are actually like taking advantage of the whole. Wasn't it overnight camping?
Oh, the safe sleep thing.
Safe sleep.
There are two churches that have opened their parking lots for that. And that's just their parking lots. Like, yeah.
They don't even have to let people in the building. They just have to let people pull a vehicle into their parking lot.
Well, and this is another thing that's kind of scary, honestly, is that we have always, because America does not really put a premium on taking care of each other, we have always sort of expected or historically expected churches to do that work, right? Like, that's one of the reasons they have tax exempt status, is because they're supposed to do charitable work.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is the most worrisome is that we are seeing so many of those religious organizations turn away from that service. And it's confusing, honestly, because like I don't go to church anymore, but I did when I was a kid, and from what I remember of that Jesus guy, he hung out with a lot of poor people.
I think he was homeless.
He seems to have been at least fairly itinerant. So that's tough to conscience. It's very weird to me, that disconnect, because like, so we are our warming shelter program and Pat's program, which is now beaconpdx.org. Check them out. They're looking for a building. Help them out. We would love to be able to open a shelter again. But we were removed by a church. Actually, oddly, the UMC, United Methodist Council, which also runs the church on over in Woodlawn, that Right to Survive and Don't Shoot used to meet in, and they showed up for meetings and the doors were locked against them. And they were just told at that point that they no longer got to meet there because of a decision by the congregation. We're seeing, like, with St. Francis, there's a new, like, I mean, the diocese is clearly, like, not down with doing houseless programs anymore.
Yeah, the St. Francis one's one I would love to explore real quick, too, because I just kind of caught wind of it about a month ago, and it seems you probably know a little bit more about what's going on. Just a little bit of history. St. Francis Dining Hall has been serving for what, like 30 years?
A long time, yeah.
And the building there is 80 years old. So they recently had to ask all of their clients, congregation, whatever you will, the houseless individuals that go there, to vacate the premises around there because they were heavily encamping on the grounds and had been doing so for, I don't know, years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I seen all that, I heard basically that it was because the city got mad about the camping.
Well, here's what it feels like and what it looked like. And I've lived in that neighborhood for a long, long time. And historically, like, St. Francis was always really welcoming to the unhoused population there. So St. Francis Dining Hall was started by a group of parishioners there. And they started a whole 501c3 about it, and they have been dedicated to that program, and I know it's very important to them. I also know that when the diocese made the deal to build the St. Francis Commons,
the apartments that took over St. Francis Park,
apartments that were built in place of the park that was a major camping destination, there was a lot of... I feel like people were promised that they would have an opportunity to apply for housing in that building. And of course, that never works out. There is no right to place, like, when we're talking about development. I mean, and the Catholic Church made money on that sale of land.
Yeah.
Like, make no mistake, this was not a charitable action for them. Whatever they may, however they may sell it. Real estate is real estate.
And see,
so
that's kind of some of the other advocates I've been talking to kind of feel that's maybe what was going on behind the whole pushback against St. Francis.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that, like I said before, it's about curb appeal. It's about making these areas, you know, more attractive to developers. And there are, like, a lot more condos in that neighborhood now that people want to be able to sell. And
yeah.
I don't know. It's always funny to me when people talk about like, say, the Illuminati or something like that, when capitalism is just its own conspiracy and there's no reason to look further. Because, yes, of course, these people are going to help each other because their interests line up.
Yeah.
So, like, and don't think the Catholic Church aren't capitalists. Listen, honey. So the diocese moved a new priest in. I don't know much about him personally, but it does sound like he was sent there to do a specific job and is doing it. One of the first things that happened was that the porch there, right there on 12th, which mm-hmm. was usually like a safe place for folks to rest overnight. And, you know, it's covered. So like that is good. And people have historically felt safe and welcomed in churches. Right. That is a natural place for people to want to sleep. Well, that was one of the first acts, is that people were no longer allowed to sleep there.
When I was there a couple days ago, there was a no camping sign on that porch.
Yep. And the part of the CEIC, that area is included in the CEIC, and they have definitely stepped up patrols, despite like them promising that that would not happen, and that houseless people would not be moved along. It absolutely, you know, people get swept, you know, every 3 to 7 days in that district. The next thing that happened, and I could be out of, you know, out of order on some of this, but I think that the next thing that happened is that it was announced that Catholic Charities is going to be taking over the dining hall program.
Hmm.
I don't know what that is going to end up meaning, actually, because of that group, that the church group that runs the program. Like, I don't think that they can be particularly like down with that. But so I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
But they announced that they were going to shut it down, shut the dining program entirely down for, I believe, a month.
Did they say when?
No, it's been kind of open-ended, but they've definitely like slowed down service. So they have less service than they used to.
Yeah.
They said they were going to shut it down to reassess, which is concerning because that could just lead to no more dining program. And with Sunnyside being shut down, there's a lot less places in the neighborhood for anyone to get a hot meal.
Yeah, and this is exactly why programs like Free Hot Soup are very important.
Yeah, exactly. And we love Free Hot Soup. We work with them. We've been doing lunch in the park, as I said. So we do Wednesday afternoons, but Beacon does Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I know they do Saturdays as well.
Which parks?
Sunnyside. So
just Sunnyside.
Yeah, okay. We are just trying to serve the population there that got kicked out of that shelter at this point.
Fair enough.
I have people over there who, when we were shut down, we started doing meals a week later, and they told me that they had not had hot food in a week in the intervening week.
Since it shut down.
Yeah.
Wow.
So those are their only hot meals.
There are not places to get hot food on the east side.
And you can't use food stamps for prepared meals. You can't get warm food. You might be able to go into a convenience store and use their microwave for something.
You get like,
that's about it.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't even get a hot dog at a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, exactly. It's very difficult to feed yourself anything other than what, like Lunchables.
So that's why people, I mean, you often see, you know, low-income people eating, you know, junk food, snack foods.
Well, and when you go to the food bank, like, it's all, you know, what is an unhoused person with no kitchen going to do with a whole rutabaga, you know? And we, you know, there are groups, and we're among them, who try to do things like, you know, how to deal with these foods that they give you. Like, how do I cook this shit?
Yeah, you said something about how difficult it was to cook a rutabaga. And I mean, that's something I've always wondered. I mean, you're sitting there in a tent, and like, not everybody's got a campfire. Not everybody's got one of those little stoves. And if they don't have food stamps, or if their food stamp card was swept, what are they going to do for food? All these pantry hours of different hours on the different locations. And sometimes you have to like schedule in advance or have ID. I remember looking this up once and being amazed that there were so many rules. You couldn't just show up and get a bag of food to go home with. It was crazy to me.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, what would you do if you have no kitchen?
That's always something that's actually really important to Portland Assembly, is to create access without barriers. And so, you know, the shelters that we run are no barrier, as close to no barrier as possible. So spouses are fine. We don't care if you are on drugs. We don't care if you have
animals
or perhaps are having a bad day that makes you have to be a little loud sometimes. Now, we want everyone to be happy and comfortable and safe. So we will encourage you to, you know, exercise that emotion in a way that is like happy for everyone, like makes everybody else feel okay about it.
Or maybe talk it out.
Or do it outside and come back in afterwards or whatever. But like, I mean, that's one of the things that we see is like people are excluded from shelters. And I have never, ever felt good about that. And especially like if we're talking about like shelters run by one of those city approved providers, like TPI or CCC. And that means, you know, you're excluded from the entire system. So like, what is that doing to somebody?
I myself had a lot of experience and I volunteered for quite a while at the Clackamas Service Center. And that's because I have a lot of respect for the way they are built. They are very, pretty much no barrier.
Yep. Clackamas Service Center is great. Shout out to them. They've been one of the only like shelters that's been consistently open this winter.
Yeah. I myself did some reporting out of Village Portland about the shelter situation over there in East Portland after you guys were sitting down at Sunnyside. Central Nazarene's not opening. Clackamas Service Center was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter also opened up, but there's quite a distance between Clackamas Service Center and Montevilla.
Yep.
So
this is interesting. A few of the shelters, from what I've heard, have been getting surprise visits from the fire inspector, which, you know, it happens, but it also feels a little targeted. I don't know. It's an interesting thing that's happening.
Yeah, see, the whole situation right now is really bothering me because, like, also, we're going completely across the city from Clackamas and Montevilla over in St. John's. You also probably know about the whole St. John's Neighborhood Association situation. My co-host here, Leslie, actually did a little bit of reporting on that. I don't know if you want to give a little bit of background there.
Well, I didn't know if you were going to jump in as well, because you also went to that meeting in December and learned quite a bit as well.
Yes.
The Neighborhood Association has been pushing back against the St. John's Village project. The city is behind this, the Joint Office of Homeless Services, the JOHS, and a couple other groups are actually looking into opening this village. They were signing the paperwork and some leases this winter, and they're looking to have it open and ready for people to move in by next December, October, somewhere in that range.
And that's the move of Hazelnut Grove,
and
right?
That might at this point, yeah. See, originally they just were looking for potentially a village, it seemed like. But it seems to really have merged together with the Hazelnut Grove Village, who has for a while been looking for another location since they've been dealing with pushback from their Overlook Neighborhood Association as well, and kind of working with them to find other arrangements other than where they've been located for the past few years.
So, yeah. And what I ended up finding out over at the Neighborhood Association meeting in December was that they were trying to change the bylaws so that I think they were trying to make the specification between active member and regular member. I don't know what the distinction was exactly. One gets more ability to vote, I guess.
That would be my guess, a participation level.
To be an active member, you would have had to provide an actual physical address, which this has been pushed back against multiple times.
They tried to do that in Montevilla, too, when we were... So Montevilla Neighborhood Association was trying to endorse the anti-sweeps bill a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And we became involved with the Neighborhood Association because they were getting pushback, and it was elevated to the level of like transphobic attacks and harassment and like some pretty white supremacist stuff happening, including Joey Gibson being invited to the Montevilla Neighborhood Association elections that year.
Wasn't that where that whole rally up there in Montevilla occurred?
Yeah, well, and Micah Fletcher, who was the person who was stabbed on the Max and was able to
survive,
was one of the people running for the Neighborhood Association board at that point. So when those specific members of the Neighborhood Association who were anti-homeless invited Patriot Prayer to that space, it definitely felt targeted and like a threat. because this was somebody who was vulnerable, you know?
Yeah, and I happened to know the reporter that was reporting on that situation up there in Montevideo and actually caught footage of Jeremy Christian in a American flag cape running around being all loud and obscene and racist and just exactly what he did on the Max.
Well, he had attacked a black woman the day before. He was not just wearing a flag. He had it chained around his neck with a chain and padlock. So, you know, real normal.
Cool, of course.
But so, I mean, that was what these folks were. And, you know, they'll say that they're not white supremacists and they will claim that they are liberals, which doesn't mean you're not a white supremacist, first of all. But they were definitely appealing to these right wing elements and willing to use them as a threat against these people that they saw as interlopers, even though everybody that was running lived in the neighborhood and most of them had lived there for years and some of them were born in that neighborhood. But because the people who were running were endorsing this homeless Bill of Rights and endorsing Montevilla taking a stance against the sweeps, they were willing to use these tactics against them.
So that seems to be a big element in the St. John's Neighborhood Association is that there has just been a vote in October, I believe it was, that changed the sort of structure of who was in charge and running the NA up in St. John's. I spoke to a member of another group that supports the villages. St. John's welcomes the village. And they were mentioning that it was a particular group of very, very anti-houseless people that chose to just overwhelm the ballot and elections and just by, you know, getting all their friends in there to vote, that they got the people in the position that are now pushing these policies against the St. John's Village Project.
Yeah, there seem to be similar things happening. It's really an interesting... Portland's neighborhood associations have a long history of contention. So when they originally occurred, the neighborhood movement in Portland was when they were building 84. And there was a huge fight about, because this was the first time they'd ever tried to really build a freeway through a white neighborhood. eminent domain is a thing that the government uses against us, but never for us. And that's something that we should start talking about, too. I don't understand why it is more in the public's interest to build a freeway to transport petroleum products than it is to build housing for people to live in. When that freeway was going through, people got really up in arms, and that was when the original neighborhood associations were formed. So in Portland, originally they were sort of populist, but have, of course, in some neighborhoods become more sort of the realm of the privileged, people who have time to go to neighborhood association meetings and, you know, are maybe a little older and more well off. And often
how to read the bylaws to get the money to throw the neighborhood parties.
Exactly, exactly. Which is really all it's about, right? It's about block parties.
It's all about the block parties.
I happen to be one of the few journalists in the city who's actually actively attending the neighborhood association meetings and reporting on them. And I can confirm it is like WWE SmackDown.
You know, I don't... I used to run a building over
not
in
raw,
Woodlawn
huh?
that
not
was raw. That was that was that we, and we would host neighborhood association meetings, and this was maybe 10-15 years ago, but I just remember lots of arguments about whether or not they were going to get historical neighborhood designation caps on the signs, and now it's people literally screaming at each other that they want each other to die. I have been to some of the most contentious neighborhood association meetings, and what I was going to say, and it seems like it's happening in a lot of these neighborhoods, is that there are these splinter groups.
Like Montevilla Initiative?
Montevilla Initiative, Lentz Neighborhood Livability Association.
Yeah.
Which is not the Lentz Neighborhood Association.
I actually went to the Lentz Town Hall on by the LNA, the Lentz Neighborhood Association, about the gun violence in that area at the Central Nazarene Church.
Yeah, I went to that.
And, oh, yes, you were there.
Yeah.
So you can attest to this. It was like 10, 15 minutes of talking about gun violence and then like an hour and 45 minutes of anti-homelessness.
There was one in Montevilla about 2 months previously that was supposed to be a forum on gun violence. And they talked about that for about 10 minutes. And then it was just like, why aren't you arresting more homeless people?
Exactly. Like, and I found that very baffling because when you were there too. So there was a few other people, journalists that were there sitting in the room as well. Zane Sparling from the Tribune. And he left early after, you know, hearing the gun violence and then them going into the homelessness. He's figured, oh, it's just going to end soon. And he left. And he hit me up an hour later and he's like, is this still going on? And I was like, yeah, it's still going on. And they're still going hard, talking very anti-homeless, like arrest these people.
Well, and it's interesting, like in that one, I was kind of fascinated because there was a member of the Lentz Neighborhood Association who said that they had recently, because of some issues, gone through a period of homelessness. And they were actually really great and forthcoming about it. And they said that they had tried to access city services through 211. They had tried to do what they were supposed to do, and they had not gotten anything.
I remember this.
Through any of those city services, and that their friends in the neighborhood had been the ones who had helped them out, and that they were fine because of that. And Ted Wheeler listened to this person say this, and then basically, like, pretended to be Oprah and was like, okay, and told one of his aides that he was going to go find that person and they were going to help that person out. And, I mean, that person had just said that they were fine, that their needs had been met by their community.
Yeah.
And Wheeler clearly did not listen to any of that. And I watched him do that to a couple of people. Like, anybody who was giving pushback, he clearly was not listening to the content of their commentary.
Yeah.
Like, and I understand. He thinks he's running for re-election. But come on, we're, like, people are dying. Like, we're serious about this.
Yeah. Oy, man, this is such a heavy subject, and we could talk for hours, I feel. but, yeah, we are coming to the end here. I want to thank you for coming in. If there's a way for people to reach out to your group or to you personally, go ahead and give them the contact info.
Well, we are on Facebook and Twitter. We're Portland Assembly. You can also email info@portlandassembly.com or alternately eastcentralnac@protonmail.com.
Nice. Okay. Well.
And that's like my group, like our little cluster.
Nice. Well, thank you, Sarah, for coming in. It's been a pleasure. Maybe even have you in sometime in the future, you know, talk about this further.
Yeah. Love to.
As always, folks, I'm Corey.
And I'm Leslie. Thanks for coming.
KBOO Portland.